I've just completed an article for the American Christian Medical Dental Association. It begins thus: a lot of clever people are beginning to say some sensible things, although the ruling elite are hardly listening at all. Most of the clever people who immediately recognized the significance of the Claudine Gay fiasco at Harvard nevertheless continued to accept the ill-thought-out affirmative action that is the DEI program. Those programs need to write themselves out of history. They need to die. Just reorganize the letters and do it. Why am I so angry about it? Well, because good people are being beaten down and bad people are being elevated. And the question is, how did we get into this state? And Ian McGilchrist does one of the best jobs I've come across in this direction. Certainly, he's making me think, and it's going to be some weeks before I processed all the stuff in the YouTube link that I put that will be at the end of this talk. It's not easy. He is demanding, but it's worth the effort. There's no question that universities are no longer in pursuit of truth. That was where they started in the 12th century and where they stayed for a long, long while. That didn't necessarily mean they did it, but that's what they said they were about. When I started doing science, taking a break from medicine, in those days, to do that was to take a cut in salary. But I did it because it interested me. And it didn't occur to us that anyone would fabricate data in the groups of people we met. Now we have no idea how much data fabrication is going on. And that, of course, is going to screw up the whole thing and destroy it, because once you lose trust in the literature, it's going to be very difficult to come back. And a lot of people have lost trust. How we rebuild it is not an easy proposition at all. Ian McGilchrist has been thinking about it for a long while. The past, he points out, thought the source of truth to be God. Throughout many centuries, the universities all accepted that, and it gave them an important foundation upon which to stand. He gives the moment of truth for him. He says he was 17 years old, sitting in his parents' kitchen with the radio on, and Solzhenitsyn's acceptance speech for his Nobel Prize was read by an actor, read well, because Solzhenitsyn couldn't get there. He wasn't allowed to come. But the line that stuck in Ian McGilchrist's mind struck him almost with a physical power of a blow. He said, "One word of truth outweighs the whole world." And what Solzhenitsyn, of course, is pointing out, and many others who were submitted to the communist Marxist regimes of the East, is lies, lies, and lies. And if you criticize those who are lying, you will be dealt with frequently in a violent fashion. They survived, but by the skin of their teeth. And it was only because some brave scholars like Roger Scruton went and spent time teaching underground in Czechoslovakia, where he is almost revered as a saint because of what he did, because he was counseled in England. And he went away to the hardest part and thought his way through and became the scholar that he became. Sadly, he died a year or two back now, and he is greatly missed. For Christian thought and Platonic thought, goodness, beauty, and truth were all considered to be sacred. In other words, they had to be given the greatest possible respect. Now that's gone. The reductive pseudo-Marxist policies, which are driving particularly the studies programs and demeaning the whole university, they have no such respect. So they are reduced only to power. McGilchrist points out that talented artists today don't want to be told they produce something beautiful. They want to be told that they produce something powerful. That's how far it's gone. This is the world we're giving to our children. They subjectivize truth, your truth and my truth. And then you have to ask the question, is that statement true? The whole thing gets into a tangle of total contradiction. The only ethics they can imagine are based on outcome. That's what they want in CRT and the other things. They want equality of outcome. But the moment you ask about utilitarian ethics, apparently Lessing was the first person to ask this question specifically, useful for what? An ethics of usefulness still need a purpose. Because obviously, if you're a Darwinian, your ethics of usefulness are based on advancing your genes, so it is not wrong to do anything that advances your genes over others. There is no morality in a Darwinian world. But a good number of people claim to be Darwinians, although they haven't thought it through. Truth has been subjectivized. That was a huge loss. It crept up on us so slowly that we really missed it in many ways. McGilchrist has now written two big books about these problems from a very particular point of view. He went to Oxford and did an undergraduate degree in English in the 70s and became aware very quickly that the great writers of the past were not being given the central role they'd always had before, because now there's a different agenda in the university, one which has replaced goodness, beauty and truth with social justice, critical race theory and all these things. They're taking a lesser good and trying to make it a primary good, and it will destroy the whole system. But when he realized this, he didn't give up. He said, obviously, there's no future for me in the arts faculty. So he did medicine, qualified as a doctor, and then became very interested in the brain and was at Johns Hopkins doing brain imaging and neurophysiology, neuropsychiatry, ended up as a psychiatrist. And the books that he's written are based upon, in my view anyway, and I may have simplified this too much, a very profound interest in the sidedness of the brain. So we all hear left brain and right brain, and men are supposed to be left brain and women are supposed to be right brain. It doesn't work that way. It's the first thing he says about that is we need to rethink the whole thing, ditch all that stuff. It's wrong. But there is a difference between the left and right brain, and they can be most easily seen with an image that you'll probably remember. You've all watched birds, especially this time of year when the ground is a bit hard, finding what seeds have survived the winter. That requires detailed attention on where to peck to get these tiny seeds that are their lifeblood, so to speak. And that's the left brain function. Left brain is very good at detail, very good at lists and management, but it's dead. It doesn't make any difference to the world. It looks at the world and grabs what it needs. But birds, as you notice, will suddenly take off in a flock, and it's not apparent why. What's happening is the right brain, which is responsible for keeping an eye on the world, decides that there are some risks and they're in danger of becoming somebody's breakfast, so they scatter, they come back and they do it again and again. There's this constant battle between right and left brain. Well, not battle, they're supposed to be integrated, and they integrate below the level of consciousness, so we're not aware of the way they integrate and what happens when they don't integrate, and what happens when the left tries to dominate the right. The right should be the master because it's looking at the global picture. It is looking at a world and responding to it and changing to it. very different attention. Tiny, detailed, bureaucratic on one side, the big picture on the other. The left brain fits in very well with a reductive approach to science, which is what happened. I mean, when Galileo started rolling a ball down an inclined plane, that was a very limited experiment. Polished wood so that he could neglect friction. Science at that experimental level has to try and reduce things that would interfere, like friction, in order to understand the basic principles going on underneath. And Galileo did that. And he was followed, of course, by Kepler, roughly contemporary, and later Newton, who reduced the world, at least the movement of the planets and so much more, to a set of very basic laws. That was reductive, but it was brilliant. It required a huge synthesis, a huge amount of intellectual energy that went into producing those laws. He spent ages and ages convincing himself that he could think of a mass point which had no physical existence, but was just a point. Was essential to the development of his physics. And the book he wrote, of course, the greatest single author text on a science that will ever be written. No one could do anything like that today. So he combined a huge right brain with a very effective left brain. He polished his own lenses, for instance. He did that stuff himself. He could do it all. What science had done was produced a system which we rather foolishly call a scientific method, as though it can be just plug the stuff into the scientific method and it will work. That's not exactly how it works. But it is reductive. It neglects a lot to get at the core. And we start rewarding that in our society because very quickly once Bacon had pushed the moral world back by saying collect facts, and he meant physical facts that could be measured. Before that, moral facts were more important than physical facts. Afterwards, they weren't. That's a big change, and we're seeing the results as our young people now live in what is basically an amoral world driven only by their own feelings. It's terrifying, but that's where we've got to. The right side could save the day. I mean, what the right side does is the things that are not measured. Processing experience, it inquires it. Meditation, it requires imagination. Intuition, all these immeasurable things. The world really is divisible into measurable and immeasurable. And what matters to all of us most are the immeasurables. And when we get these things wrong, there's trouble. It's a lovely quotation in McGilchrist from Whitehead, where he says that a culture, this is Whitehead speaking, a culture is in its finest flower before it begins to analyze itself. That's lovely. And you can see that. People who found themselves pursuing science with such passion and such intuition, they didn't look at themselves at all. It was selfless. Whitehead goes on, when we navel gaze, we lose the effects of the wisdom in literature, poetry and art and the like. McGilchrist is in this wonderful hour-long plus talk making us think more carefully about the bits of education that I was privileged to receive, our generation was, but we've allowed it to evaporate in the modern world. And what we've got in place is idiocies like CRT. For centuries, of course, many centuries, the only real education people had was in church in the Western world. That was the only place where ordinary people would have some sense of something greater than themselves. That's why peasants and nobles worked together to build in silence Chartres Cathedral, with the ability bringing the wheelbarrows to the craftsmen. And they built cathedrals to which people went, not as tourists, but to worship God. And so when you go into a Gothic cathedral, you drop your voice to a whisper, and your eyes are forced upwards to the cross. And the church is based on the cross as a plan. Chartres Cathedral is a giant Bible study, which we've only worked out in the last few years with high-resolution photography, that you can walk round it, you walk round it the right way, you walk your way through the Bible. That was the world in which they lived. Their priorities were different from ours. Their life was nasty, brutish and short in many respects. And the only way you can deal with that is via hope. And that's what Christianity brought. Faith, hope and charity, and the greatest of these is charity. The love of God for us and our attempts to love him back makes a different world. All the great religions of the world have a great book. So the biggest religion, as Chesterton points out, was the Book of Nature, and it produced animistic paganism, which makes sense. If you live in Central Africa, the world does not look as though it's made by a God of love at first sight. It takes a lot of faith, insight, to get past the brutal realities of what was infant mortality in Africa, now dropping, but still a long way to go. Up until the antibiotics arrived, virtually every family in the world, if they got to any size, would have one child die of meningitis, because bacterial meningitis was always fatal till antibiotics came along. Until Jenner stumbled on vaccination, smallpox was a regular killer. Jenner's crude vaccine worked, and it was subsequently made better, and we've got rid of that disease. Sadly, both Russians and Americans still have it in laboratories from which it might escape if it gets into bad hands, and that will be a tragedy of the first order. So, what people learned in that way was a tacit, very limited world. I mean, many priests didn't have a Bible. Many couldn't read anyway. It was pretty primitive. There were great scholars at the top who were writing and thinking about the story of Christ. And it did lead to Benedict and the preservation of learning and the growth of the monasteries, which were the forerunners for hospitals, etc., etc. But it was slow, very, very slow. Centuries had passed with minor change. But what did happen was an ethos was created which produced works of art, things that people memorized. I mean, it's always amazing to me to think a little later that ordinary people would go and listen to Shakespeare. Nowadays, the kids can't listen to Shakespeare. They haven't been sufficiently trained. Shakespeare has got biblical allusions on pretty well every page, and the audience watching knew all the Bible stories. They could see what's going on, and they knew about life. You put those two together, and then the genius of Shakespeare. But you couldn't imagine ordinary people going and listening to Shakespeare nowadays, or at least that's too unfair. It takes a little effort. We have locally, where I live, Shakespeare on the St. Lawrence in the summer, and it's always good to see the people there enjoying it. When we only had oral transmission, everything had to be memorized. So childhood was critically important, because that's when your memory is at peak performance. So children can memorize a poem or a psalm under the age of 7. They'll do it in a few minutes. It's the one thing they can beat their dad at, and dad should use that as a means of stimulating them to memorize more and more good stuff. Of course, we now look down on that. We don't teach times tables. We don't do it by memory and then have competitions who's fastest. Kids love that. And what you're doing is giving them a sense of number, which They don't have now. I remember many years ago being shocked when I said to a graduate student, well, make a micromolar solution. And he didn't know how to do it without a calculator. He couldn't sit down and work it out. In other words, he was innumerate, if that's the right word to go to, illiterate. He didn't have a real understanding of number. That was real education. And, of course, the medievals understood that. The first thing in education is grammar, by which they meant everything you can memorize. And when you start saying how and why, then you taught logic, classical logic. Only after that did you get to the trendy stuff that we all like, and we called it rhetoric. Obama was marvelous at rhetoric, but he didn't bother with content. Terrible choice. But that's what he made as his choice. So that world has decayed because we haven't been rewarding the world of great productions. Scruton, for instance, made a lovely video documentary for Scottish BBC on beauty. And they don't push it at all because he's really pushing back at all the modern nostrums, which are reductive. To see everything through the lens of feminism or through the lens of social justice, they use this phrase, the lens of something that constricts everything, instead of trying to fix things together. Lewis understood a long, long while ago that most heresy, as he put it, is a good thing in a wrong place. When the Bible was central, truth came first, and with truth came competence. But once you move to power and identity politics, then truth is pushed out of the way. It is subjectivized, and all that matters is power. And lies go on all the while. Now back to McGilchrist for a minute. He makes this very interesting comment. I saw what he was complaining, or what he described so beautifully long, long ago. Occasionally, you'll get patients who are demented, who are having minor strokes, probably as well, and they lose the sense that their limb, what one side of their body belongs to them. They actually complain about somebody being in bed with them because they don't recognize one half of their body as being theirs. We would just smile and encourage them and calm them down. But McGilchrist points out that this is worth thinking about a lot more. When somebody has a right brain stroke, it's much more dangerous in many ways than the left brain stroke because the integrating power and the bigger picture is lost. And the left brain, it's not altogether nice, as he points out. The left side doesn't like being wrong. It's not very good at being corrected. And it doesn't mind lying and confabulating in various ways. You'll see that in left-brained politicians who have virtually no moral constraints on them at all. Denial and delusion are much more common after damage to the right brain than to the left. Also, anger is dominantly left brain. These things are not unimportant, are they? I hope I've given you enough to want to go and look at McGilvray. For some of you, it'll be an important and delightful experience. For others, it might be more of a struggle, but I think it would be worth it. Let me know.